Hello and welcome to the weekly edition of ESG Now, the show that explores how the environment, our society, and corporate governance affects and are affected by our economy. I'm Bentley Kaplan, your host for this episode. And on today's show, we're going to get into some of the questions being raised about ESG-related investing in the US. And that's because we've seen a ramp up of legislative efforts to either discourage or encourage the use of ESG data in investment decisions. So firstly, we're going to talk about what is actually happening in the space. And then we'll dig a little deeper into the backlash against ESG investing by starting with two of the main points being made by some critics. And then we'll try to figure out how investors can potentially navigate this increasingly complex situation. Thanks for sticking around. Let's do this. Now, first up, a quick note. This episode follows on from a previous show that Mike hosted called Everyone Hates ESG. In that episode, Mike and our colleague Megan Eastman dug into criticisms of ESG that were mostly about how to define it or what people believe is the correct way to do it and other perceived shortcomings in the models or the data or various investment approaches. It's a very helpful explainer of the state of the ESG investment world, and if you want to find out more, please do go check it out at the end of this episode. Now on today's show, we're going to kick off by looking at a backlash against ESG investing, particularly in the US. One where at least some of the participants object to the idea of considering environmental, social, or governance information in investments at all, rather than questions of how to define it. Now, if you read some of the headlines, it's quite easy to be distracted by the rhetoric that sometimes accompanies this debate around ESG. And instead, today, we're going to put that to one side, and we're going to talk through some recent developments and explain our view of ESG and the role that it can play. Now, within the US, things are kind of happening at two levels, right? At the state level, we're seeing a patchwork of proposed legislation that's either trying to incorporate ESG considerations in the investment process or looking to exclude it where it's deemed non-material. In some states, there are proposed bills that aim to compel state pensions to divest from funds or fund managers that engage in ESG investing. But on the flip side, other states have proposed bills in favor of either including ESG considerations in investing or at least making it optional. And it's also a little bit more complicated than that because ESG-related investing might be regulated in different ways depending on how it's interpreted or what specific areas of ESG investing are being focused on. Right? Restricting investment in fossil fuel-related activities is very different to, say, compelling companies or investors to report on their climate emissions. But both of these are tied to ESG and ESG investing, albeit in different ways, which we'll come back to a little bit later. So that's at the state or local level. But then, at the federal or national level, we're seeing the same sort of push and pull, where there are those advocating for the use of ESG data in investment decisions and those that are against it. And this push and pull was really highlighted following the November 2022 decision of the Department of Labor to implement a rule called Prudence and Loyalty in Selecting Plan Investments and Exercising Shareholder Rights, a rule that falls under the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA. Now, in essence, this new rule allows plan fiduciaries, who are basically the managers of things like 401k funds, to quote, consider climate change and other environmental, social, and governance factors when they make investment decisions and when they exercise shareholder rights, including voting on shareholder resolutions and board nominations. Now, it's worth noting that this rule does not compel these fiduciaries to use ESG data or mandate its application, but rather allows for its inclusion in investment decisions. In response to this new rule from the Department of Labor, in January this year, 25 states filed a federal lawsuit stating that the rule, quote, prioritizes woke environmental, social, and governance investing over protecting the retirement savings of approximately two-thirds of the US population. In late February and early March, a bill that sought to overturn the Department of Labor's new rule passed through both the House and the Senate. It was unclear at the time of recording whether President Biden would ultimately veto this bill. So, with increasingly polarized headlines and growing legislative pressure, the first thing we wanted to do was to consider two key criticisms that are being put forward by those who have made clear their anti-ESG stance. And I'm going to take these criticisms and put them to my colleague, Megan Eastman, head of New ESG Research Solutions, who will be joining me through this discussion and as someone who has seen the decades-long evolution of responsible investment through its many iterations and acronyms. So, Megan, thanks for joining. Let's start with the maybe more controversial criticism, this assertion that ESG, writ large, is being used to impose liberal ideologies onto companies and investors and their employees.
Yeah, okay, so we do hear that in some of this criticism, but, you know, there really is nothing subversive going on here. So let's just back up a little for a minute, because as I mentioned in the previous episode, there are lots of different ways that investors can use ESG data or ratings in their investment process, and different reasons to do it as well. And the most common reasons are financial. It's taking whatever information might help deliver better returns or reduce risk or et cetera. And some investors then also have non-financial goals on top of their financial goals. And those might be things like mitigating climate change or protecting human rights or maybe avoiding activities they don't find compatible with their religious faith. And I think that some of the questions around ESG can be traced back to a confusion between these two concepts, the financial and the non-financial goals. And you might see critics of ESG looking at that first category and assuming that actually it's the second. Or they might be looking at the second and then thinking that somehow that's being foisted onto investors or end savers without them knowing or wanting it. Now, I'm going to come back in a minute to the ESG for financial goals, but I want to dig in a little bit more on that second category first. So using ESG information to target non-financial goals in investments. And this is a thing that people do and have done for a long time, like back several decades to the early days of this industry. And that's especially been true amongst faith-based investors. So, you know, if you want to make sure you're not investing in companies that sell tobacco or something like that, you can use ESG data to do that. Or if you want to target investments into companies that are providing essential services to underserved markets, you can do that too. Or, you know, just focus your investments on companies that pollute less and treat their workforces better. And like I said, lots of investors have goals like this alongside their financial goals. And at this point, we've got years worth of evidence now that it is, in fact, possible to do both, that you can target non-financial goals without having necessarily to compromise on the financial ones. And sometimes it even helps. So the question isn't, are investors doing this sort of thing, but really more about why and how. So if you think about the basics of the investment ecosystem, you've got individuals like you and me who own assets, basically our savings. You've got institutions that own assets like pension funds on behalf of beneficiaries who are, again, people like you and me. And you've got managers of assets who deal with the day-to-day management of it all in exchange for fees. So managers of assets have to attract and retain clients, whether that's my parents or my pension fund. And in one scenario, asset managers might then develop strategies or funds that have some of these non-financial goals because they think it will attract clients. But they won't attract those clients if it's not pretty apparent what they're doing, which I think incidentally also should mean that potential clients who don't want it won't sign on because, again, it's apparent what's being done. And then the other scenario is that an asset manager does this because it's actually in the mandate from the asset owner client, and they must do it in order to get or to keep that contract.
Okay, right. So ESG data can be used in efforts to meet non-financial goals. And I suppose that in these sorts of non-financial goals, we're talking about a very wide range of applications. But whether or not investors choose to include these non-financial goals would depend partly on their clients' interests or the investment mandates that guide their processes. So then let's maybe talk about the second major criticism of ESG, which is that the use of ESG data or ratings or strategies is in direct opposition to maximizing returns over certain time horizons. Megan, how does that criticism strike you?
Sure. So this argument is not actually particularly new. From the earliest days of ESG, and I've been in this field since some of those earliest days, there was always this question of whether using ESG information could actually lead to financial outperformance or whether, by definition, it would actually lead to underperformance. And as time has passed, there's just a lot more evidence and history to help answer that question. And the upshot is that first, these things are not inherently incompatible. Considering ESG information does not have to hurt performance. But even more than that, we've learned that if you use it right, it can in fact help. Now, anecdotally, there are loads of company examples, right? I mean, think about something dramatic happens, it's in the news, A car manufacturer is found to be using devices that cheat emissions tests, say, or a global mining company has a massive tailings dam collapse, or destroys an Aboriginal heritage site. These events have their roots in how the companies were or were not managing environmental or social or governance matters, and they all had hefty financial impacts on share prices, company valuations, legal costs, all that. So having access to ESG data might have helped investors to see events like that, you know, not as sudden and unpredictable and out of the blue, but sometimes as part of a broader pattern or trend, a lack of management of a certain type of issue. But that's all anecdotal. The really interesting evidence comes from empirical studies looking at large universes of companies over long periods of time. Now, here at MSCI, we've conducted and published quite a bit of this research ourselves, including several studies that have been published in peer-reviewed research journals. Just as a couple of key examples, you know, if anybody wants to go look this up, I'd point to a series of papers that are called The Foundations of ESG Investing, and then another one on deconstructing ESG ratings performance. And just very high level, we've found that companies with higher ESG ratings, which means those companies were doing a better job of managing financially relevant ESG issues in comparison to their industry peers with similar businesses, that these companies were more profitable, that they had higher valuations, they were less likely to suffer major drawdowns than their peers, again, same industry, with low ratings. And studies from major asset managers and owners have found similar sorts of results. So all of this research does help contradict assumptions about underperformance when you use ESG information. But, you know, I also find it really fascinating in itself, because what we're seeing is that ESG is not just about avoiding downside. It's also about benefiting from upsides. And it's not just about avoiding or managing those dramatic events that might make the headlines. It's also about growing or eroding value over time for shareholders.
Right. So in the shape of investing for financial goals, ESG is looking to be an increasingly accepted strategy. And as this evidence grows and we learn more about how ESG data can be collected and structured and applied, we may see ESG take its place alongside other long-accepted investment tools and philosophies. Ultimately, Megan stressed the point that ESG is just information, and financially relevant ESG information can help investors make investment decisions in service of their financial goals. And at the same time that this is happening, regulators are focusing on better and clearer disclosure of ESG-related data, including the SEC, which is looking at new requirements for companies to report climate change data. And as more and more companies strengthen their disclosure, ESG data will provide additional insights for investors seeking to meet both their financial and non-financial goals. And look, we can have this academic debate on a podcast and pore over findings of ESG investments and how they link to financial performance, but let's maybe turn focus to investors that are currently looking to navigate this challenge. Megan, are there specific ways in which these investors might think about responding, especially given all of these moving pieces?
You know, it is unquestionably a challenging situation for many investors and investment managers these days, and maybe especially for those that are trying to operate across shifting and increasingly divergent policy contexts. But as we all continue to make our way through this debate and as the environment continues to evolve, there are a couple of points that I keep coming back to. The first one is that ESG data is just information. And information on its own doesn't have an agenda. It's really all about how it gets used, and that's different from one investor to another. The second thing is that markets work better and more efficiently when there's more information available to everyone. That means more information about companies and other assets, and more information about investment products and decision making. And then third, ESG information has proven to be useful for financial purposes. So for the achievement of financial goals, it doesn't matter whether you believe in it or not. It just is. And then last thing, the name isn't the important bit. The utility of the information and the results that you can achieve or that you do achieve are really what matters.
And that is it for the week. A massive thanks to Megan for her take on the news with an anti-ESG twist. There isn't usually a dull moment in the world of ESG, and this week was certainly no exception. Thank you very much for tuning in. We hope that we've helped to give you some context on this complex topic, and that you feel well-equipped to wade into a debate over ESG that happens to crash your next bake sale, coffee date, or kids' football game. If you do like what we're putting out there into the world, please do give us some stars on your platform of choice. It means a lot, and helps others to find the show as well. But until next time, take it easy and take care. The MSCI ESG Research podcast is provided by MSCI ESG Research, LLC, a registered investment advisor under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 and a subsidiary of MSCI Inc. Except with respect to any applicable products or services from MSCI ESG Research, neither MSCI nor any of its products or services recommends, endorses, approves, or otherwise expresses any opinion regarding any issuer, securities, financial products or instruments, or trading strategies. And MSCI's products or services are not intended to constitute investment advice or a recommendation to make or refrain from making any kind of investment decision and may not be relied on as such. The analysis discussed should not be taken as an indication or guarantee of any future performance, analysis, forecast, or prediction. The information contained in this recording is not for reproduction in whole or in part without prior written permission from MSCI ESG Research. Issuers mentioned or included in any MSCI ESG Research materials may include MSCI Inc., clients of MSCI or suppliers to MSCI, and may also purchase research or other products or services from MSCI ESG Research. MSCI ESG Research materials, including materials utilized in any MSCI ESG indexes or other products, have not been submitted to nor received approval from the United States Securities and Exchange Commission or any other regulatory body. The information provided here is as is, and the user of the information assumes the entire risk of any use it may make or permit to be made of the information. Thank you.